Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch brings you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's WWE Monday Night Raw.
Javier, was Roman Reigns a babyface tonight, talking about Logan Paul the way that he did and interacting with The Miz?
I think it's more, he's definitely kind of felt like he's fallen into the gray zone because people are going to cheer him anyway. I wouldn't say he was like full-blown babyface, but he was definitely playing into the cheers.
Yeah, because like JBL was like a babyface talking about how great Texas was in Texas until he called everybody whatever, you know, buzzwords he learned on Fox News or whatever it was that like 8 years ago when all the words he used were a thing. And then, of course, you know, there was almost no reaction because it's like this is a really tired, boring gimmick. Then he threw in a couple more insults in the crowd, which was sort of sleepy the whole night, booed a little bit. Reigns didn't take that twist. Reigns just everything he said was at the expense of Logan Paul and of course, punching Miz and knocking him down. Regardless, I think you're right. I mean, I don't think he's turning babyface, but I think this was, and I wouldn't even say this is testing the waters. It's more just a logical thing to do given the circumstances because Miz had the history with Logan. Roman's upset that everyone's talking about Logan knocking him out. So Reigns is like, I'm going to knock Miz out to show people I have a Superman punch that is formidable, and that's what people should be talking about. So I thought this segment worked, but I came away from it going, this was a fun little window or teaser into the babyface Roman character who's calm, cool, collected, and charismatic, and the fans just eat up everything he has to say, and he acts above all the nonsense and, you know, whatever heel he's against, he's going to play off of them with minimal but really effective body language, facial expressions, and a few words. It's a remarkable turnaround from, you know, where he was 5+ years ago. What do you think of the segment?
Yeah, I thought it was great. Everything that everybody involved with the Bloodline right now, it's not just the storylines, but it's how everyone's delivering their lines. They're holding the lines just the perfect amount of time to let it sink in. They're, with the exception of Friday SmackDown, where everything fell apart because of the, you know, everybody cracked up, you know, which was great for different reasons. With the exception of that one, everyone's basically been, you know, they're holding their what the stuff, the little stuff that they do, how they look, how they act. I mean, Heyman today was when he hands, when Miz comes out and, Heyman goes to hand, you know, Roman asks for the mic and you hear Heyman say, oh, this is my favorite part.
you know,
just little things like that, which I don't think they can be scripted. I think this is stuff that's, you know, they're running, you know, that they're ad-libbing, you know, based on who they are and what the characters are. So it's these little things and knowing how to milk the moment. And I'm like, where was this Roman years ago?
I know.
In terms of holding the moment, I mean, it is different. It seems like he's engaged because, I mean, I'm just remembering when it was, you know, do what I'm told and hope to get rich. You know, that's not the sound of someone who was engaged in what he was being asked to do. I think that he was just waiting for the moment to, you know, do this kind of character.
That's the thing, and I think he had to grow into it by having a bunch of main event matches and becoming the senior member of the roster in a way. I mean, you know, Brock's been around longer. There's some people who've been around longer, but he was never – I don't think he was ever equipped personality-wise to be somebody who asked – for praise or cheers. He sort of needed to earn it through, you know, effort and output and time because he is a natural, his character, and I think his personality too, is more, has grown into being more of a natural tribal chief. And so basically what happened is time caught up to who Roman Reigns was always destined to be as an effective main event character. Because when he was, you know, broke off from the Shield, you know, he was the junior member from an experience standpoint, from a work rate standpoint, from a fan respect standpoint, and he didn't know what to do with it. And Vince McMahon wasn't having it. He was either wasn't aware of it or was in denial about it or thought he could just push past it, and the fans weren't having it. And now we're in a different place. And, you know, I think people feel that Reigns has earned it. There's not a lot of resentment over him being a part-time guy as much as people look at him now as a bigger star because he doesn't need to show up every week. And when he does show up, it's treated and framed as a big deal. And when he does appear, he's surrounded by a bunch of lackeys who are and sycophants who are all like competing for his approval. And I think fans, for whatever reason, and you can maybe expand on it or give your thoughts, are really into that character right now.
Yeah, because it's all about him connecting with who he's doing, which is, I mean, granted, had he turned heel earlier on, it would have been a completely different path. I just think he would have been engaged more than when he was at what he actually was. So obviously, you know, you couldn't do the, you know, acknowledge me thing when he was, you know, younger, because obviously he didn't have the breadth of career, you know, to be able to get away with that. But, it, you know, I think he would have been engaged just because I think he enjoyed the more, you know, like the more viciousness kind of, I think it would have ended up being more engaged. But yeah, I mean, it just so happens that you now have, you know, the whole, you know, you throw in the whole bloodline thing and the tribal chief thing, which is like working, you know, perfectly. I the question about him turning babyface eventually is, I don't know. Cause I mean, the kind of way that they've had him do since he requires cheating and stuff now, you know, every major match, you know, we kind of forget about that, but he's had to cheat to win or have an unfair advantage to win. And I think that ultimately his downfall is going to be him trying too hard, you know, because, you know, as other wrestlers that he's wrestling get closer and closer, him, you know, trying too hard. So I think they might just end up like just kind of letting people cheer him or boo him, and kind of keep him doing what he's doing, you know, cheating to win and that sort of thing. I don't think they're going to be like a full blown baby face and just let people cheer him or not, without really like pushing too hard one way or the other.
I think the definition of a baby face in pro wrestling is somebody who is primarily, scripted to get the better of the person verbally who they're standing opposite of. And they're generally standing opposite of people who are heels. And how do we define who those heels are? They're heels because they otherwise face people who are clearly baby faces. Like, you're not a baby face because you're Bob Backlund or you're Hulk Hogan or you're John Cena. You're a baby face because fans are drawn to you, and the wrestling company and the booker and the wrestler himself and those who surround him play into that by letting him seem like the more admirable, likable person. But that can take on a lot of different personalities. And Roman's babyface persona is going to be being the adult in the room around a bunch of idiots and arrogance and, I mean, whatever. You know, the whole array of what makes a heel, and there's all kinds of them. Roman's going to be the adult who just stands there and through little facial reactions, kind of Batista-like, in that the little facial reaction or body movement, which he's so good at right now, you know, for all these examples are popping into my head. He'll use that against the heels, and the crowd will be hanging on his every word and movement and eat it up. And he'll be a babyface by definition just because he's mostly matched against heels, and he's not made to look showing ass in the end. He won't be showing up in the end. Fans won't be rooting for him to be humbled, and he will not, as you say, cheat to win. But once he starts pandering, where it seems, well, what is pandering when he says, acknowledge me, and the crowd cheers and he smiles? Like, I think he can get away with that. Like, that's not pandering, and I don't know that it's in him, because we saw when Vince was trying to push him as a traditional babyface, he didn't have it in him to pander. That was one of his problems. He couldn't do that fired-up go-home babyface promo before pay-per-view. You've got to be able to do that. You've got to make it seem like you care that the fans – you care if the fans are cheering you. He couldn't do that. He couldn't fake it. He didn't care, or he couldn't at least convey that he cared. He's now going through this cycle where what makes him popular is he doesn't need the fans' cheers, but they cheer him anyway. So I don't know how far we are away from him being primarily matched against heels and being booked in a way that, you know, fits, checks a lot of those babyface boxes. But I think tonight was an example that it's going to be a battle to delay it too long. And when it happens, I think it's going to work.
Yeah, I think but that's, I hesitate to use baby. He's definitely the protagonist, you know, because I don't like, because my issue with Babyface and Heel is that they don't feel like, in our lexicon, they're like diametrically necessarily opposite. Because, you know, the way I see it is the babyface is the protagonist, and he is the protagonist of the story. So, you know, the guy that you cheer for. And the thing is that, you know, occasionally, because the character that he's playing is not necessarily like the most noble character. I mean, that was what I always said about The Fiend. The Fiend was the babyface during a storyline. He was not a good guy. You know, and I think that's kind of what they're going to go with that, where, I mean, you could call it babyface, and they'll probably tone down some of the stuff until they're ready to go to the final, like his final act. Cause I really do think his final act is the, I cannot think of a story in pop culture right now to really, to compare it to, but, the guy that, you know, by the end feels like he's beset at all sides. I just thought of one, but it's a horrible example. Like Hitler at the end of his life, where, you know, everything's coming apart. He realizes everything's, you know, and he just goes nuts at the end. That kind of story. I think that's kind of the fall that you plan for. But this is like down the road. We're talking about like years down the road when you're ready to, you know, move on.
They're gonna turn Roman ultimately babyface by following the path of Hitler's death in his final months.
I'm not. I knew that was a bad. I mean, this is the first
came
out.
You warned me, but I'm gonna dwell on this for a minute. Huh?
That's a baby face. That's a baby. He's gonna go through a baby face route, and then he's gonna be that one character at the end. I cannot think of another one. For some reason, that movie is the only one that pops into my head. You know which one I'm talking about? The one they made all the memes about. I'm not
helping you.
I know. I'll probably remember by the end of the call. But hopefully people know what I'm meaning. You're horrible, Witt.
Thank you. So basically, though, a fun segment with Reigns and Heyman, just the two of them. You know, we didn't have Usos and Sammy. And Solo, this was about hyping Crown Jewel. Well, on a serious note, did you think they effectively built up the Logan Paul-Roman Reigns match, including referencing Jake Paul getting a decision win over Anderson Silva, and which, I don't know. Anyway, and that to build up the Paul brother brand, and then the idea of pins in his hand, and Heyman really accentuating that. Did they do an effective job, given what they had to work with, getting people to not think Roman's going to lose the title, but at least think there's a story to tell here that I want to watch play out?
Yeah, I mean, Logan Paul will probably get in a lucky shot, and there's going to be the gasp. Well, I mean, it's going to be in Saudi Arabia, so you're probably not going to get that level of engagement, but there's going to be the gasp of like, oh, maybe this is the moment, and they'll tell a story in the ring. You know, which you kind of like guess that it's going to be dominant Roman Reigns. He's probably going to get cocky, get caught with a punch, you know, go on the defensive for a little bit, and then, you know, and then end up dominating him. I mean, that it's pretty much the same story you get when they pair someone who's, you know, unable, you know, someone who's like, you know, not on the same level as his opponent, but he gets like a little bit of a hope spot in there just because the other person was not taking him seriously. I think that's what ends up happening. I don't think anything they did is really gonna like make people want to tune in any further, but you know, at least they gave you reasons to believe why Roman's gonna have to sell for him at some point.
Yeah, and I think they've created a scenario where when Roman sells for him, it won't seem ridiculous.
Yeah,
and I think that is the hurdle they had to leap over, or the threshold they needed to achieve is just not have it seem ridiculous that Roman doesn't just walk in there and spear his ass and score a three count in record time, and I think they've achieved that. It is a spectacle match. They are acting like it would be a lucky punch that would drop Roman. And I think by doing that and not, you know, pushing Logan Paul, WWE's not pushing Logan as this likable hero who you should cheer. and they aren't pushing him as a credible threat to Roman Reigns beyond the lucky punch, because he's got, you know, pins inserted in his fist is basically a built-in metal detector setting off weapon that he carries with him legally to the ring. So I think they navigated these waters, I think, in a smart way to minimize the backlash. And I think, you know, WWE fans, you know, have resigned themselves to the idea of these Saudi Arabia shows, you know, just being, you know, WWE's paid a lot of money to put together spectacles and dream matches and Braun and Omos and Shawn Michaels out of retirement and on and on. And this is one of them. And you can take it or leave it. It's a, you know, early, it's a Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon type show. And it, you know, I mean, I think there's resentment over some of the stuff that they do, but I think some people are like, well, I'm glad I don't have to pay money in person to see this. I don't sense a lot of fans are like, hey, why did Saudi Arabia get this match? But I still think they're going to go, ah, I already got Peacock. I might as well tune in and watch. I think they've done okay. Okay with this and done an admirable job given the headwind of getting just the internal story logistics of trying to make it seem like Logan, it's not just appalling that Logan is even in this match.
Yeah, Scarface, wait, that's a better example. Scarface, end of Scarface. He, you know.
There you go.
His fall. There we go. Thank God.
Yes.
Could you edit up all the Hitler stuff, please?
Oh, you know I will, won't.
Oh, sure, okay.
I think I said, you know I will, I meant won't.
At least it's a six.
Yes, yes. All right, let's pause and introduce ourselves, and then move on to more conversation about this and other topics. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Monday, October 31st, 2022. And I am Wade Keller, the host of the program. I've been covering professional wrestling since I was in high school as a hobby and then a job for 35 years now. It's crazy. And I'm glad you joined us today, downloading or streaming our show. I'm the editor, publisher, founder of the long-running Pro Wrestling Torch Weekly newsletter. We'll have another issue this week for our subscribers. So VIP members and paper copy subscribers, you can look forward to that. And also, I host a lot of podcasts, including post shows after Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Also, the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast, our Blue Logo Show flagship, and a bunch of VIP shows, including the aforementioned Fix with Todd Martin, Everything with Rich and Wade, post pay-per-view and PLE roundtables exclusively for VIP members, the Wade Keller Hotline, and more. The other one here so far is Javier Machado. He is a PW Torch contributor, both on the podcast and written website side of things. And he is here to talk Raw with me tonight on Halloween evening. Javier, are you, I don't know your housing situation. Do you get kids knocking on your door, or did you flip off that front porch light, or do you have security keeping the costumed critters away from you? What's the situation?
My neighborhood's pretty much aged out. So not too many kids in the area, except for like, they're either really, really, really young, too young to really, you know, go out trick-or-treating, or they're no longer around. So
gotcha.
Older neighborhoods. So.
Yeah. Cool. We had a few kids, the grandma's bringing the grandkids over. But there's a lot of Sour Patch Kids and Skittles left, which is not good news for me.
Yeah. We're in the same situation. We got a lot of candy here that I'm going to have to go through in the next 2 days.
Yes. So if there's any teenager who wants to steal all the candy off the front porch, you know, I won't be mad. I mean, I'll be mad, and then I'll be like, oh, that's kind of rude.
Thank God.
Anyway, happy Halloween, everybody. Because it was Halloween, we did get a trick or street fight match, which we'll get into. Not too much else, but I think we got the line of the night from Kevin Patrick. You know what I'm talking about, Javier?
Which one?
The line of the night during the trick or street fight.
Oh, what was it? Because I had a couple.
My line of the night, my pick, is when Elias put the pumpkin on Otis's head. Kevin Patrick said, finally, a head that fits the size of the body.
Oh, I missed that.
Yeah.
I missed that one.
It was great. I don't think it was planned. Maybe it was. I shouldn't say that. It probably was written for him. But his delivery was good. And the visual of Otis stumbling around the ring with a head that, did seem more proportional to his body was really amusing. How about you? You said you had a couple candidates?
Well, I mean, just some stuff that stood out. Nothing. I have to go through my notes, but the fact that they mentioned Art Anderson, which was surprising to me. The line of the night would have been Heyman's. Oh, this is going to be good. I love this moment. He went through the Miz. I thought that was one of the best moments. Yeah. So, and I think there are a couple more that, as we go through it, I'll see if they show up on my notes.
Cool. Sounds good. All right. Well, let's give out the phone numbers and the email. If you want to participate in the show, if you're live streaming our show at WadeKellerPoeShow.com, give us a call, 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call push 1 on your keypad, that flags you on our switchboard, so we know you want to be on the show. You can also email us at WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, Javier, there's a lot more on the show. We had the Johnny Gargano explanation for the Miz Dexter situation, so I want to get into that later. We'll talk more, I suspect, about Riddle and Otis and the women's tag team title change in the main event, and just other crown jewel hype. So we'll get into all that as the show gets going. We don't know yet what our callers will bring up, so we'll begin to let them lead the way. And we'll go to Brad in New York first. Brad, thanks for calling. You're first up tonight. What stood out for you on Raw?
Hey, Wade. Hey, Javier. The show, first of all, had, I thought a really big start. Like, you had the Brock segment, and you went right into Seth and Austin Theory, which just was a really good match, and then right into Roman. It just felt like it had, a lot of, big things going on early that almost, got overshadowed in a certain way by, the end of the show with, the tag team titles changing hands, which I don't know why I got legitimately excited about that, just seeing Damage Control go down, and I actually really enjoyed seeing that, and, the things that happened in the last hour and whatnot. But, I wanted your opinion on this, first and foremost, is the Usy, the Usy thing, I mean, it was very funny, and I'm a huge fan of humor in the WWE. I loved the Otis segment tonight, and even that Otis match with the pumpkin on the head that you just referenced. I thought that whole thing was great. I thought Gable was so funny. So I love all the humor, and I really did enjoy on Friday night the Usy segment and all that stuff, and I thought it was just masterful and really well done. But I'm wondering if you foresee it becoming a little bit of a problem, because – you have signs all over the arena when Roman's in there that say Usy. You have, people chanting Usy, Usy, while Roman's in the ring. Roman obviously addressed it in a funny way, but I'm just wondering if it kind of is going to go too far where, it almost, becomes, just a comedy act. I'm not saying the Bloodline is going to become a comedy act, but is that comedy element something that longer term is necessary? Zayn said the Usy thing 3 or 4 times, and it never caught on like it did from Friday. This time it really caught on. It just, whatever. Do you know what I mean? I don't think that the Usy thing, while as funny as it is, should become a central part of everything the Bloodline's doing. And I'm a little, I don't say worried about that, but I just kind of wanted your opinion on that.
No, I think it's a good point. I think it's a worthwhile point to discuss. Javier, is there a chance – I'm trying to think of examples in wrestling or otherwise where something caught on and it was fun, but it actually ended up being a bit of a distraction from what was more, important going on. What do you think, Javier?
I would say just about every single catchphrase that they have. The girl, uh-uh. Was one of them that was felt like was extra, it was ad-libbed at the moment, and then people liked it, and then it became her catchphrase. Get these hands, I believe, was ad-libbed by Braun Strowman, and then that became, he had to work it into everything he says. That is a concern of them playing it into Usy. I have to hand it to Roman Reigns, because it almost felt like he was playing along with it, but just enough where you could almost say he was mocking it too. That he was, mocking the actual audience doing it. It was just something of a vibe that he was giving out with it. And also, which was interesting to add a little bit to that segment, because that was him addressing the bloodline, and the fans chanting that was basically them saying, hey, we're more interested in what's going on with the bloodline than we are with this Logan Paul situation. So he addressed it, and he mentioned that, and he said, okay, now we're going to move on to the Logan Paul situation, you know, which hasn't really, you know, blended much into the bloodline storyline with Sami Zayn and stuff. But yeah, I do agree that if you start, if it's fine if Roman's not around, that they play into Usy a bit, because when Roman's not around right now with Sami Zayn involved, it is a little bit more of a comedy, but you know, mixed in with you know, the what's going on with Jay, who's basically like the straight man versus, you know, Sami. But when Roman Reigns is around, you know, it's kind of like what you mentioned, that he's the adult in the room and we're going to go ahead and stop this right now. And it does feel like, you know, when he does refer to it, like on Friday, again, Friday problem was everyone was cracking up. And on Friday was, is this what it means that you're not Usy? And like, you know, it's like, you know, is that what it is? That he's just using the term without really embracing it. It's just that, you know, on Friday he kind of cracked up, and today that's why I'm saying that it felt like he's a little bit more mocking of it today, which is really what he should do. As far as the rest of the bloodline, particularly Jimmy and Sami Zayn, they could be more the comedy acts, as long as Jay Solo keeps his solo away from that, and Reigns stays away from that.
Yeah, I saying that Roman is mocking the Usy thing is interesting, because if you look at it through that lens, it's like he's almost laughing at his underlings for being into something so juvenile. But it also felt like sort of just a wink and a nod and a tip of the hat, a wink and a nod to the audience that, yeah, that thing sort of did catch fire last week, and we're trying to get ourselves back on track a little bit. And so now I want to get real with you. You know, even he overtly said, now I want to get real with you. And now it's a transition into handing the microphone to Heyman to hype a match that he thinks is beneath him to hype. But I think there's something to it, that the Usy thing, if Roman especially, if you're right, Javier, there's going to be no problem. He's already kind of self-aware of it, knows his place is to be sort of above it. But if he gets a kick out of this and leans into it a little much, it could backfire, in that it's the type of thing that could run out of steam really quick, or only works when it's underlings doing it, and mostly Sammy, whose character, of course, can say that line and be cool because he's cool because of how uncool he is. Once Roman seems like he's co-opting it or trying to jump on board, it looks like he's not late to the party, but he's glomming onto something that's working for Sammy, and it might seem like a bad fit for his character. So I guess stay tuned. Brad, I think your concern is, you know, is good to bring up, and probably based on what I've seen with Bloodline and their work, probably something that Reigns and Heyman and Sammy and the crew are already cognizant of the possibility of, and will probably navigate pretty successfully. That would be my thinking. You know, we're only a few days past the everyone breaking character, and I think they navigated pretty well tonight. But you know, in 2 weeks we could be revisiting this, thinking no, they're not. Brad, back to you. Any thoughts on what Javier especially had to say?
Yeah, on what you guys said, you know, I almost think the best way, if you're going to lean into it a little bit, is to have Roman almost, you know, address Sammy and say, you know, I'm keeping you around because I find you amusing. You're going to amuse me. Like, almost like you're going to be my jester. Like, you're going to be my, like, almost like the, like in the storyline way that, like, you hear that Vince thought about R-Truth. You know, like, he kind of just keeps him around because he finds him personally entertaining. You know, like, almost like that sort of thing. Like, the king finds you entertaining, so you get to stay. I think that would be the only way that you can kind of lean in more than they have to this comedy part, because it's very funny again, but like it you don't want it getting out of hand. Especially that line that just caught fire. And just, I thought about it when I saw how many signs there were about Usy and how many people were chanting it. And, you know, you don't want this to become the thing of the bloodline. And that would not be good for the overall storyline and who they are and everything like that. But I digress. Like, you know, I thought Byron Saxton in the 60 Minutes role was pretty good. You know, that was obviously some mockery of 60 Minutes with the clock ticking and everything. His cadence was a little slow, you know, he I think he did a good job acting like he was like a Scott Pelley or something. But with Gargano in that segment, you know, I find it hard to believe that anyone is sitting there saying, yeah, Johnny, tell him what Miz did. Yeah, Johnny, go get him. Yeah. Like, Johnny Gargano in that segment, it was, and he has been for a few weeks, but was so annoying, almost like a tattletale telling the teacher or telling everyone what the mean kid in class did or what the guy he doesn't like did. Like, it's very unembraceable. And I think, you know, like an I'm telling on you and the whole story he was telling about Miz is paying money and he's, you know, this is why he's acting. You see right here, he was acting like he was getting pulled away and it got out of control. Like, it just seemed like such a far-fetched story. Even if it was true, it just seemed like total speculation on his end. And I understand this is all silly stuff and it's not, you know, anything super important in the real world. But, like, if you're trying to get Johnny Gargano over as a character that people want to like and want to love, I don't think this is the way to do it. I find him to be, you know, just annoying in this role and almost like a whiny character that you'd see on, like, Curb Your Enthusiasm or Seinfeld. Like, oh, this guy's telling on everyone, you know? Like, I don't know what you think on that, but I just thought that was really annoying and not a good way to kind of showcase him as someone you want to cheer for.
Yeah, I've expressed my lack I think the direction of Gargano's character has been a miscalculation or revealing of something that for whatever reason didn't come through in NXT. But whatever he's doing is not working for me. And I didn't think tonight helped. You know, there's sort of a delivery to the lines, like, well, since it's 2022, I recorded it. And I just don't quite like the tone and inflection of him telling punchlines. It's like he thinks there's a cleverness to what he says that isn't there. And that's like really annoying. There's like this big wind up and then he says it and he says it with this tone, like, you're all with me on this and this is funny and we're not with him and it's not funny. And I don't think it was working at all. So that we talk about the Dexter storyline as sort of a separate issue, what they're trying to pass off as what happened here. And if we'd like that, but as far as the Gargano character itself, Javier, where are you on it?
As a continuation of the NXT storylines that they were doing, I'm fine with it because I did like the whole Gargano way and the comedy that they were doing then. And this feels like essentially it took that Gargano and they kept that direction. The problem is that worked because people were already enamored with his work. They were enamored with him, you know, as one of the top guys in these hot feuds that he was in. And then they pivoted to give him something else to do while he was on NXT while other people were involved in the top stuff. And it was, and his storyline was essentially a mid-card comedy gimmick at that point. And what they did is they basically just took that Gargano and dumped him into WWE, which is a bigger audience, without really backfilling any of that stuff. We got most of that during this segment where he talks about, you know, the family that he was adopted to, and they finally gave you all this backstory that happened on NXT, which, you know, is something that should have played out a lot for people to be able to glom onto the type of character that Gargano's become. It's almost like if you watch a TV show, by the seventh season, they start becoming self-referential. And at that point, like, you're already in this show for so long that you're laughing when they, you know, when they reference the same thing, you know, the things that they do, you know, over and over again. That's kind of what they're doing with Gargano, except he's only been in the main roster for a short period of time. So, you know, someone who jumps into a show when the show's already doing that self-referential humor, they're going to miss the jokes. So, you know, the character's not going to be as, you know, there's no opening for you to get into that character. You know, and then that's also playing with, you know, also setting aside the fact that it might just not be your type of humor, it might be the other thing. So as far as like his character's development, if you followed him all through NXT, it doesn't seem like too much out of it unless you're expecting, you know, high level things from him. But my you know, the issue is that not as many people know that journey that he was on.
Well, I think all that's good, pertinent points, but what do you think about the delivery and his material and his delivery in light of the reality that, hey, I mean, I followed him in NXT and I don't find this anymore. I don't find this particularly, his character particularly effective or clever, and, or I don't find him likable in this role. Having followed his NXT journey, I think you're right. It is even less so for people who haven't, but do you think it actually is working for people who knew him in the way and know his backstory and bring that with them? Because I'm not sure that I'm in that category of, well, I think I get it even if others don't. I just don't think it's good for anyone.
I think the thing is with it, the material hasn't been great. So it's like if the stuff that would have ended up on the cutting room floor in NXT, I think that's kind of what they're – a lot of what they're using. There have been a few moments where I've giggled and I've laughed. It's just not as many as when, you know, the way was all together back on NXT, because he was also playing off of a lot of other people. But, yeah, I mean, and then some of the stuff that I think were missteps was, like, the MC Hammer pants, because that because I remember that was a thing. He was referencing something that happened on Twitter, that people were making fun of the loose-fitting clothes that JBL was wearing on his first appearance as Corbin's manager, and people were calling him, you know, MC Hammer pants, and then he was basically referring to something on Twitter without, you know, giving any
explanation. What is this, AEW?
Yeah, I had the same thought. So,
yeah.
You know, so yeah, I mean, and that's the thing. It's like he was, and also keep in mind that he was also portrayed as a heel when he was doing this on NXT too. So
yeah.
That also doesn't help, because now you know he's doing a baby face, and I think, you know, people, like, when he was a heel, some people, you know, liked it and, you know, like, you know, cheered for it because, you know, it was fairly fun. But he's being, you know, he started off as a babyface. And I can see why someone would say that he feels like a tattered tattletale during with what he did.
Yeah. All right. Back to you, Brad.
Yeah. And it's not just, you know, even when last week when he was dancing with JBL's cowboy hat on, I'll bet you 75% of the audience, 80% weren't cheering him on. They wanted to see him get his ass kicked. Even though JBL was such a jerk, because he's kind of being a jerk. He's kind of like almost like teasing a little bit, like teasing you and not teasing you like, oh, what's going to happen next? I mean, like teasing you like a child would tease you with, you know, little dances and little kind of, you can't get me, whatever. But I don't know, just that whole segment really didn't make me like him anymore, or actually make me like him less, but his character, that is. But onto things that were funny really quick is, you know, I think that Otis with the bow tie, with the dancing moves and everything, I mean, that was really, really funny. And even R-Truth, you know, I like that they're using him. And I like that for the last 3 weeks, it was on Raw last week, it was on NXT last week, and now it was on tonight. Anytime someone in the ring says the word truth in their promo, he comes out. I mean, I think that's kind of like a funny way to use him, you know, and he comes out with the song and everything. And I'm so happy he's back on TV, because to me, he's one of the most entertaining parts of what Raw has going on. And really quickly on the main event, and this will be my final thing, but I was genuinely excited when Damage Control lost and when Alexa got that pin on the Twisted Bliss move. And I was wondering, do you guys think this is an indictment on Damage Control? Because I feel like Triple H doesn't like to change titles. Like, I feel like he doesn't want to be the guy to yank titles off a team or off an individual in a month or two. And I don't know why this happened, unless maybe the thought is Bayley wins the championship at the pay-per-view here. But I would even find that surprising with Bayley having pinned Bianca twice already. I mean, is she really going to win three times? I mean, I don't know. But regardless of that, I just want to know more so, do you think that this is an indictment on damage control? Like, hey, this isn't working, and we're going to give two of our bigger female stars the stage to run with these tag team championships? Or do you think that this is setting something else up and, you know, maybe it'll be back on them soon or whatever the case is? And that's about it. And I'll listen to what you have to say.
Great. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate it. Yeah, Javier, show ends with the tag team title change. I didn't expect it. I wasn't, like, shocked because it's the women's tag team titles, and it's, I don't know. I mean, it's a credible team opposing them with two stars who have been in top spots before. But I didn't expect it. I was anticipating some other finish. What was your reaction to it? Why do you think they did it? And what do you think of what Brad said about Triple H and his, if we have enough evidence, his tendency when it comes to the frequency of title changes?
Well, I mean, he's inherited long title reigns, so I think he'd be not, you know, he wouldn't be jumping, changing those titles just because they've already been, you know, something's already been built with them. Indictment is a bit too strong of a word for me, but I do think that they needed to shake things up a little bit. And I think that was the whole purpose of that. I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, the feud continues with these two, you know, between the two teams, and maybe they end up winning it back at some point, unless the idea is that he really has soured on the group, and then Bayley loses, and then, you know, infighting in the group breaks out, and then they all go their separate ways. That's the other you know, the other possibility. So I think it really mostly is going to depend what happens on Saudi Arabia, whether, you know, Bayley wins or Bayley loses, whether this team, you know, whether it is an indictment on damage control or not.
What do you think of Graves complimenting Alexa Bliss for her aggression? And we haven't seen it in a long time, and that's what you need to be successful in WWE. I thought Vince McMahon was back on the headset for a minute there, you know, ruthless aggression. They've been telling that story with Liv Morgan. Paul Levesque now apparently is instructing Corey Graves to tell that story with Alexa Bliss. Is it a coincidence? Is it meaningful? What do you think?
I almost think that it's like, because she's been kind of disconnected from the character because she hasn't been able to find the character. And I did notice that she was more assertive. They said aggressive, but I would actually say the word assertive would probably fit her better because she, she cut the promo, which, you know, to this point had been, you know, when they've been together, Bianca Belair is pretty much the only one talking, with the other two just getting a couple lines in. But she, you know, she was the one who called for the match, and she was the one who asserted herself during that backstage segment. And then when you watched them come to the ring, she's the one who took the lead and told the other two to follow her. So I think it's more of an assertiveness than an actual aggressiveness, but I could see that would say, you know, oh, she's more aggressive. Although, you know, I pretty much saw her more or less wrestling as she'd been wrestling for the last little bit. But, I think that assertive would have been, I think he said, aggressive, but I think, to fit in the wrestling parlance, but I think what he was really pointing out was assertive.
Interesting. Does this make you think it's more or less likely she ends up with Bray Wyatt?
I think this actually made me think less likely. The thing is that if Liv Morgan's going to end up involved in that storyline, there's going to need to be a woman to face her. So if she's on Wyatt's side, then I can see, you know, Bliss going, you know, back to her dark side and feuding against Morgan, or the other way around, depending on how pieces fall. But the fact that she's got the title now, maybe it's going to be a longer term storyline or longer term thing they're going to do, or they just jettisoned what they had planned for her, you know, in terms of what she was going to be involved with that, and basically essentially gave Morgan her role, you know, what would have been her role.
All right. Very good. Our number is 347-215-8558. You are invited to call us and push 1 on your keypad when you call, and we'll bring you onto the show. Or you can email us at wadekellerpodcast@pwtorch.com. All right. Up next is Grant from Detroit. Grant, thank you for calling. What's on your mind about Raw tonight? Go ahead, Grant. What happened to Grant? Going once? Going twice? All right, we'll see if he calls back. I was just going to bring up a follow-up before I went to Grant, and I'm trying to remember what it was. Oh, I wanted to go back to the Gargano thing. I don't want to forget to do this. What do you think of the story that Gargano said? Because we analyzed, you know, Gargano's delivery and his one-liners and all that, but what do you think of the actual content of the reveal?
I'm glad you went back to that, because I did want to emphasize the fact that I'm not saying that this is the best use of Gargano. I'm just saying that I understand what they're going for. That's
two different things. Yeah.
You could be doing a lot better stuff with Gargano than this. This is obviously my, you know, personal likes. I like the little stuff that they did with Gargano doing the reenactment and stuff like that. But I was wondering how they're going to explain this, because this has gone on so long, and the reveal, you know, that's like, what can the reveal possibly be? And I'm like, you know what? This actually, for me, kind of fits. It fits the Miz's character that he wants, you know, he wants to basically, you know, create sympathy for himself. You could kind of totally see Miz doing this kind of thing, and then, you know, decide not to, follow through on his promises to Dexter Lumis. I think it was a little bit over the top of having him, like, you know, Lumis, like, you know, working, you know, drawing art in the, you know, out on the street. But, you know, but, yeah, I mean, it could have been a worse reveal. At least it wasn't, let's put it this way, at least it wasn't a giant spider in a box. you know, but it'll move the story forward too. So
for people who listened to us and don't watch Raw, I feel like the context of how we talk about things is enough for people to kind of know what we're talking about. But Javier, here's a challenge for you. Explain the reveal for people who are listening to us in the morning on their commute or at the gym, in their morning routine, who for whatever reason they're out trick or treating with their kids. They didn't see Raw, and they need a little context for what you just were talking about. What did Gargano reveal?
Well, the idea is that Miz has been paying Dexter Lumis to stage these fake kidnappings in order to essentially drive up media attention. And he found him, you know, after he got fired, after Dexter Lumis got fired, he hired him to do this sort of stuff. And then at some point, and this is, and they had evidence, because they actually had a recording of Miz's voice, unless it was like a really good deep fake, of Miz having this one-sided conversation with the silent Dexter Lumis. So, you know, he paid him off to do this stuff, and then apparently at some point decided he's not going to help pay off Lumis anymore. And then Lumis, you know, basically wanted his money and went after and started attacking Miz for real. That would have been one of my favorite lines of the night, was from Gargano, when he said that, you know, he had Lumis attack him during the cage match because Miz knew that he couldn't beat Bobby Lashley, because it's the Miz. Come on. He's not going to be able to beat Bobby Lashley. That was one of my favorite lines, because, you know, that's almost like, you know, in reality, because that's one of the things that we were talking about, is like that this is not a credible match to have Miz in a cage with Bobby Lashley. It's one of the, you know, one of the talking points. And then basically Organo says, this is the Miz. He's not going to have a chance against Lashley. So, you know, again, more meta commentary, which I know turns a lot of people off. I dug that line. That was one of my, personally one of my lines of the night.
I thought Byron Saxton, I think there's some good and bad in what they did at every level, the execution and concept. What I thought was good was Byron asking the logical questions that would be asked. I'm not saying necessarily asked every logical question, because it was quite the, quite the situation. It'd be hard to make total sense out of everything. But the question of why about the U.S. title situation and Dexter, you know, ruining Miz's chance, Byron should have asked that, and the answer was smart. You know, the answer was that Miz wasn't going to have a chance to win, and he knew it, and he wanted an excuse, so it helped, you know, forward the storyline. of Dexter and Miz to give Miz attention and hire a Hollywood stalker to not really hurt him but look like he's threatening him. But that it would have been for people, and maybe there's more to the story where it doesn't make sense and they just sort of had to exclude it. But I think they pulled it off by just saying Miz knew he wouldn't have had a chance to win this title. And it might even in retrospect explain why they did that weird match to begin with. You know, because at the time we're like, why are they even doing this match? So anyway, yeah, the short of it is I think Saxton did a good job in his role, and in terms of the questions that he was told to ask and how he asked them, it didn't come across as farcical and goofy as it could have, even though it had a bunch of both of those things too.
And he didn't have Corey Graves shooting down all his logical questions.
Yes, yep. All right. Yeah, I guess I have, you know, thinking about the choice they made or the fact, okay, here's my question. Do you think they planned this all along? Was this a story all along? Or were they like, we have a better idea or we have no idea, but this will work?
Are you asking me, did they mystery box it? J.J.
Yeah.
Abrams reference. I think they mystery boxed it. I think they just basically started doing stuff and then like, we'll figure it out later. That's what it feels like to me. It's just, I mean, normally you would see more like much bigger holes in gaps in logic. And you could ask,
the case.
Yeah. Cause I mean like, you know, why go into the cage then, you know, cause the whole purpose of the cage was to keep Loomis out. So you're basically putting yourself in a more dangerous situation with Lashley. That kind of like, okay, that's kind of dumb. You know, so you could ask other questions and go deeper into things and then like some things start falling apart. But I think they did enough where by cursory examination, we're like, okay, let's move on to the next segment. To the next segment of the storyline.
Yeah, I haven't gone back and examined it, and I don't know that I will. And I think they covered enough where for most people it'll be satisfying. But it won't shock me if we get some emails or find out, you know, through social media or whatever, people are like, that works except for this and this, and they had to avoid addressing it. And that might reveal that they, you know, came up with this afterwards or midstream as opposed to it being a master plan. But it's possible those things don't exist. Nothing jumps out to me. And I'm not ruling out that they didn't have this plan from the beginning. I mean, I asked it earnestly because I don't know the answer. It doesn't, as of this moment, seem obvious to me either way.
Well, I hesitated on that because, you know, modern Hollywood movies, since they go through a lot of writers, you know, a lot of revisions, a lot of like the pop culture movies have like, you know, plot holes that you could drive a truck through.
Yeah.
So at least this one, if it was planned at the last second, it felt a little bit more concise. But the fact that, you know, they kind of felt like the segments just kept on going and going and going, and they just, you know, kept pushing the reveal further and further down the road, which is like over on the SmackDown side of things. I hope that, you know, they don't do the same thing with the Bray Wyatt stuff and then keep pushing that, you know, dragging it along for like ever. So, you know, give us some answers at some point.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. You want, even if it's just a little bit, you want to move down the field towards the end zone, towards the payoff, and not just, you know, stall at the line of scrimmage every week, saying the same platitudes and spooky stuff. And for sure. But I mean, it can be a, you know, 3 yards at a time type march down the field, but they got to progress with the Bray Wyatt stuff.
Give us some first downs.
Yeah. And it doesn't have to be, yeah, it doesn't have to be 12 yard passes. It can be, you know, 3-4 running plays. But you don't want people to lose faith that they know where they're going, and you don't want people to resent that they're stalling for too long. Okay. Let's go back to Grant in Detroit. I think he's back with us. Grant, welcome to the show. What did you think of Raw?
I thought it was a decent show.
Yeah.
Trying to catch up to the end right now, but yeah.
All right, well, you called us, so I'm throwing to you here.
So my thing was, well, y'all were talking about the babyface turns. What do y'all think? Did it seem like they were dipping their toe in Seth Rollins maybe going babyface?
Yeah. Look. Good question. Yeah, Javier, what do you think of Seth against Austin Theory, how the crowd reacted, how the wrestlers steered the crowd, how the announcers steered the viewing audience, how the style of the match told, you know, what story they were trying to tell with the selling, the body language, the offense, the comebacks, the transitions. What was going on there with Seth in Theory? And, you know, we talked about Roman testing the waters, being a babyface in his promo. Is that what we saw tonight more so than we have to date with this incarnation of Seth?
Yeah, it kind of felt that way with them putting Theory on there. And that was another line of the night when Corey Graves said, that is what the kids call a banger. Just because I thought of you and said, you know, that's what the kids call
yep.
dope nowadays.
Yep.
It kind of feels that way. Maybe they're, I don't even know if they're testing the waters of just, you know, like the current is in one direction. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I think people like singing the song. I don't know if they're like super invested in Seth Rollins necessarily winning as more as they were invested in Austin Theory not winning. Unless it was my imagination, I think some people tried to start an Austin chant and they were shot it down
yeah.
really quick.
Yeah, that was funny.
I do think that the match, because I thought it was a really good match. It felt like it was, what this felt like was they said, hey, Rollins, go out there and make a Theory look good. Is kind of what they felt like, you know, to prove that this guy can wrestle. To the fans, and that's what this felt like to me overall.
And mission accomplished in that regard too.
Yeah. So I mean, like I said, you had some people start chanting for Austin, so which is like, you know, wow. I think that's more of the what they did with him. I think they're going to continue doing the whole, you know, ostentatious Seth Rollins character, and kind of let the crowds kind of turn him babyface. And really get engaged with that version of the character if they get really, you know, into that. I think that's what let it go. I kind of feel bad for Mustafa Ali because, you know, since obviously it looks like he's going to be what they're setting up is Seth Rollins and Ali. And if you don't really, like, emphasize Seth Rollins as a heel – most of us are going to suffer because I don't think he's strong enough of a baby face to get cheers over Rollins.
All right, Grant, back to you. Your thoughts?
I just seemed to make sense. And then the only other thing I had was, do you all think that that title change at the end of the night is just going to be a transitionary reign to probably get the belts on Ronda and Shayna, maybe?
Yeah. Javier, what is this? Are they going to just switch the belts back quickly, or do they move them to someone else? And, yeah, Ronda and Baszler, interesting if Ronda were to become a dual champion. Has that crossed your mind?
When they won the titles, my first thought was like, okay, if they don't go back to EO and Sky, who are they setting this up for? And then I just had, you know, briefly thought, you know, I first thought to some rumored, you know, there've been rumors that they're talking to some of the women they've let go, like Chelsea Green, I think, might be coming back at some point. And they said that they're talking to other women. I'm like, maybe they're going to bring in like another tag team. And they're using this, you know, for as soon as they come in to go directly against her, again, you know, for the, you know, put them in the top level storyline. I did not get around to thinking about Shayna and Ronda. And the interesting thing about that, because I didn't really pay too much attention to their interaction last Friday. You know, so I just really got it from, you know, listening to PW Torch stuff. And I heard it might have been more a little bit more contentious, but I do like the idea of them teaming up together for a while before they have a breakup and wrestle for the titles.
All right, Grant, back to you.
That's all I have for tonight. You all, go ahead, get to the next few callers and go VIP.
Thank you, Grant. Appreciate it.
Yeah, I got to thank Grant because it got my imagination rolling that, you know, the two of them tagged together, Rhonda and Baszler, and they tried to out, to out-hurt their opponents and, like, you know, have, like, an internal team rivalry as they try to be more and more cruel to the people that they wrestle.
Yeah, interesting. All right, our number, if you want to join us, is 347-215-8558. If you call, push 1 on your keypad. First-time callers, always welcome. Get yourself invited. One of the themes of this show that struck me, Javier, also struck JB from Detroit. I want to read this email, though. Hey, guys, Wade has spoken several times since Triple H took over creative of the absence of irritants in his is a signature change in the booking of WWE. I personally felt a lot of those irritants showed up on tonight's Raw. A few examples include the trick or street fight as a holiday-themed garbage and the Chippendale show with Alpha Academy. I personally found this funny, but I found two of those shticks on the same show as overkill. Number two, goofy, convoluted interview with Johnny Gargano, weekly explaining the Miz Loomis angle, which has gone on for way too long with a seemingly very weak payoff. And three, far too long of a main event with a seemingly random and inconsequential title change between several women who have been trading back wins and beatings for several months. Now, Bliss and Asuka also feel like a very forced team to me. And four, the contrived obligatory pull-apart brawl between Lashley and Lesnar, which I'm pretty sure they also did before their match at the Royal Rumble this year. Not sure if they decided to phone this show in because of Monday Night Football and Halloween, but it sure felt like it. As always, love the show and everyone go VIP. I give them a bit of a pass because it's Halloween and it sort of feels like it's, you know, you're obligated if you're a WWE booker to do silly stuff. But you're not also, you know, like Paul Levesque could have really made a statement about his booking approach not being, just a continuation of Vince McMahon by having Halloween come and go. And he resisted going down this road. I don't think he's under pressure to do this. It must be, I think, because he believes in it. He thinks some frivolity and silliness and wackiness when you have the excuse because it falls on Christmas or Halloween or Thanksgiving, that's a good part of a winning part of the WWE formula and what the WWE audience expects. And there's less risk continuing with it than there is steering sharply away from it at the first opportunity here to do so. But it did seem like we had the return of some of those irritants, I find R-Truth amusing a good amount of the time, even if I have some issues with, you know, him being like this court jester character. And anyway, but even him coming back, because of a pun or a play on words of, you know, the truth is, says Baron Corbin, and here comes R-Truth. We're starting to see, I think for people who are watching WWE and giving it another chance because Vince left, are finding that it's not particularly different than if Vince were still booking. And in that sense, it's a bit of a lost opportunity for Levesque, but they have so much money coming in from all these deals that he's not living check to check, month to month, week to week. And that was kind of the point that I was making last week with Rich on the flagship and everything and the everything simulcast. Is I just think, you know, Triple H is judging his performance and is being judged. His performance is being judged differently than other bookers because there's so much money coming in. Part of his job is to just steer clear of icebergs and not carve out new routes and just keep this thing rolling and have the big buzz generating social media enticing segments like Bray Wyatt and you know, the Gargano or the Miz Dexter mystery. It's like, it's not just about creating contenders and creating a sports-like vibe and building around a champion or multiple champions. A lot of it is just having the next spectacle and social media storyline, conversation-generating, buzz-worthy angle. And part of that formula apparently includes holiday-themed wackiness. Javier, your thoughts on that range of points?
You know, I don't mind the holiday thing. I do understand when they could go over the top. I didn't mind, you know, I wouldn't really call those irritants. It's just stuff that you might not like. You know, more of an irritant to me is when you have storylines that peter out and don't go anywhere, or get dropped in the last minute, when the show doesn't mesh well together. During this, the one thing I give them credit for, the holiday, the trick or treat, the trickers, whatever street, I can't even say it.
Trickers street fight.
They had, you know, they tied it into ongoing storyline of whatever is going on between Riddle and Elias, because Riddle came out dressed like Ezekiel. So, you know, it's tied to stuff that we already, you know, that, you know, it already, you know, is pre-existing. The Chippendale stuff was, I found it familiar, but I had to actually look it up because I couldn't remember what it was, what it was a reference to. So, and you know, I'm like, wow, you know, check your demographics, man. Callback.
I think Wade Barrett came up with it.
Yeah. And then like, I like the callback to the Caterpillar, because remember one of the first things that Chad Gable did was forbid Otis from ever doing the Caterpillar again. And this time he said, you know, one time. And then, you know, he did the Caterpillar, you know, or Worm, for, you know, people who don't know what the Caterpillar is.
What if they don't know what the Worm is?
Well, then you're out of luck, man.
Okay.
obviously, they're carrying old school with the Chippendales reference. From Saturday Night Live. The truth segment, it was a miss. Sometimes it's a hit, sometimes it's a miss. So I thought it was a total miss. And this one had a lot more than you would probably want on a show that might turn you off. But here's the thing: you had, instead of each thing being its own segment, you had storylines weaved throughout the show to make you want to continue watching it, because you started off with the Bianca Belair, and then that broke down into setting up the tag team match for later. You also had the stuff with Roman Reigns and The Miz, which set up both the match with Mustafa Ali and the reveal of what Gargano did. The show feels more like the stories are like interwoven, and it's not just like, okay, here's a 15-minute segment, here's a 15-minute segment, here's a 15-minute segment. It feels like one show. And it also doesn't help that it's a three-hour-long show, too. So it's, you know, I felt it start dragging in the middle, pretty much from the JBL coming out until you had to, you know, from that point on, it was kind of the nadir of the show. And it wasn't until pretty much the women's match where I felt like it got me back into it. But yeah, I mean, that's just my thoughts. Because a lot of stuff that we, you know, irritants, like you said, is like stuff that doesn't make sense is more for what I find more irritating than anything.
Along those lines, Jay from New York emailed, and he said, Monday Night Raw isn't over yet, but I felt compelled to send a few thoughts to you now. This is another painful episode to sit through. No one is being built as a future challenger for Reigns. Rollins is U.S. champ with no challengers either. I don't know who Theory upset, but it feels like he's in a doghouse. Damage Control might be the most boring faction in wrestling history, not named the Dark Order. JBL is at least trying to be a heel in 2022, but he cut that promo to the wrong audience. That promo needed to be in front of an AEW crowd, not WWE. Oh, by the way, why is Baron Corbin with him? That pairing makes no sense for either guy. It's been a few weeks now, and Triple H's creative is leaving me cold. Maybe I'm too harsh. Thanks, and take care. So that's Jay from New York. Couple things here. Well, first, I don't think Austin Theory is in a doghouse. Do you think so? based on how he's being booked?
Absolutely not. I mean, look at the amount of time he got in this match. He looked like a star. Just because you're losing matches does not mean you're in the doghouse necessarily. That's part of, you know, the growth process for teams. Watch the NBA. NBA, you might have a team that comes together and they lose like one, two seasons before they start clicking and hitting. It's part of the journey of becoming a championship level. If he were in the doghouse, he would not be given TV time.
Yes. Not everybody's getting pushed is winning all the time. You're getting pushed when you get that kind of TV time against somebody of Seth's level and you look like you belong in the ring with them.
Would you say that Gable's lost every match? Are you saying that he's
in the doghouse?
In the doghouse?
No. But I think what I was about to say, and Gable's a really good person to interject, nobody expected Gable to be on a trajectory to be a main eventer. But Vince McMahon making Austin Theory the chosen one, again, kind of a Drew McIntyre, John Cena hybrid storyline of I'm choosing you, you're going to be the guy. I think people are like, oh, well, he's being fast-tracked, so anything less than just plowing through all his opponents and winning, it means he's in the doghouse. And I just think he's on a long he's on a journey. He's young, and they're taking their time, and I think it's an astute choice to take their time with him and feature him the way that they are and give him breaking point, you know, things to brag about, the youngest this and all that. But in the meantime – yeah, I mean, I think they're preventing a backlash against him being overpushed, and there's plenty of time to flip the switch on him, whether it's turning babyface or just growing, you know, getting better over time. You know, I mean, if you follow sports, not every rookie is as good as they're ever going to be, and you watch them make mistakes, and you watch them have setbacks because of their mental approach to the game, and a lot of that is a story I think that they're telling with them. But to me, I still look at how Austin Theory is being treated, and I think almost everybody around his age on the undercard would hope to be positioned the way that he is. So that said, well, I'll just go through these. Is it a problem that WWE isn't doing more to make it obvious that they're building up contenders for their singles titles? And again, I talked with Rich Van last week on the flagship and everything, the Everything VIP podcast hybrid, and made that point that I don't think that's essential to Triple H's day-to-day tasks as booker of this era of WWE, because if there isn't going to be a Roman Reigns title defense anytime soon against anybody else because they're focused on Logan Paul and whatever comes after that, I'm sure they have in mind and they're just not showing their hand. Or I don't think you need to have, like, in this formula of WWE booking, three contenders and people are going, which one's going to get a title shot? That's a more sports-based approach to booking. I would like that, but I'm also okay with and accepting of, if not embracing, but accepting of the idea that WWE is in a different business right now. They're not trying to sell tickets to monthly house shows where you got to have the next challenger ready when the champion retains against the current challenger. It's kind of different now, and they're more into telling stories and building factions and, like I said, social media buzz stuff and hocus pocus and special effects and all of that stuff more than telling a sports-like story. So I could imagine a different version of me over the years pushing back hard against this, but with all the money coming in and how much it seems like the Bray Wyatts and Bloodline type storylines are working or have potential to work and seem to resonate with the audience, I don't get too worked up over there not being a long line of challengers ready, because I'm sure Paul Levesque is thinking about that and Reigns is thinking about it, but if they're not going to get around to somebody being a challenger to Reigns until next summer, they're not, because they've got their plate full with the Bloodline storyline and one or two other challengers between now and then, they're not going to show their hand, and they don't want to make it feel stale by the time they get around to it. Javier.
Yeah, you likely have The Rock for WrestleMania. You also have Cody waiting in the wings when he comes back. Don't forget that
Sammy.
Sammy now, but before the Sammy thing took off, it looked like Kevin Owens was going to be involved. Because I think it was an interview with Sammy, I think, mentioned that the original idea was that this whole entire thing with Sammy and the Bloodline was only going to be like a 3-week comedy skit, and it basically took a life of its own, and which is why you haven't seen Kevin Owens involved, because the idea was that eventually down the road it was going to be Kevin Owens teaming up with Sammy, and you know, at some point you could have had at least a one off with Kevin Owens going up against Roman Reigns again. Do you want to continue? You do want to continually be building people, and if let's say Lashley beats Brock Lesnar, you've just had here another person that has beaten Brock Lesnar, ready to face Roman Reigns. So you know you have you know you are there are people out there. Gunther, at any point, you know, just continue him with the, you know, dominating what he's doing. And then at some point you could have him be a challenger for Reigns. So you do have some people that are like percolating, but the thing is that, like you said, you don't want them to be necessarily the obvious next man up. But you want to have people like, you know, involved in something and that you're interested in. Sheamus, I mean, Sheamus is another possibility depending on where this Gunther thing goes. So, you know, You've got some people that, again, they're not going to be like the guy, because my argument back with the Cardiff show was, you know, that the only one I saw like positioned to be the next guy was Drew McIntyre. I think that ship has sailed now with, you know, after that moment. You know, you would have to do a lot of like rehab to get him back to be the guy. Do they have the guy? No, I don't think they do. But, you know, that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. So all you could do is just have credible challengers for them.
And good stuff there. Is Damage Control the worst, most boring faction since Dark Order?
No. I mean, I would say they're listless, but that's, you know, I've seen a lot of wrestling. I don't hate them. I just kind of wish they had better direction. That's a different thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good word, and just like sort of underwhelming, you know, given anticipation for Bayley coming back, and
considering the way that they debuted and the steam behind them when they first debuted, where you know people were like, oh my god, this is gonna be awesome, and I think a lot of people were like had visions of what the women's division when NXT was at its best was like, and I mean. Hopefully we start building up more of that. I mean, I'm a bit concerned because of that, like Nikki Cross becoming, you know, going back to Nikki Cross and kind of being the sanity of Nikki Cross a little bit was a positive, but then she just lost to Bianca Belair. And even though there was, you know, distraction, I didn't like that because you already gave her a loss the moment that she changes over. At least run with her to be somewhat of a threat to somebody before you have her lose like that.
Yeah. How about the JBL character? He came out there. And what crossed my mind is at least he's saying these things as a heel, not as a babyface or a controversial color commentator who's like, you're not sure if we're supposed to be nodding along or not. Unlike, you know, I still get hung up on, you know, Daniel Bryan's character being an environmentalist who's in favor of limiting carbon emissions, and that you're supposed to have a crowd of 10,000 people booing it. I never got that. I thought that was just such a weird heel character, and it's like, well, it's how he says it. Well, no, that should not override the fact that it's really important what he's saying. Isn't something that people just, you know, scoff and boo. JBL's out there saying all these trite, you know, 5-6-year-old, you know, conservative talking point buzzwords. And the crowd it's meant for him to be booed for that. And you even had R-Truth saying, you know, you're this, what was the description of him? A sad, out of touch old man or something like that. And it's like, yes, that's the character, that he's playing when he's out there talking about the young, entitled, lazy, self-space-seeking generation. And it's like, it's meant to be an eye roll, not cutting edge. At least I think so. I don't know if JBL's in on it, but I think everyone else is. And so it's meant to get booed. But so that's good, I guess. But they have skipped this huge part of the bonding process between Corbin and JBL. And that is, I think, what people are way more interested in than JBL entertaining himself with these, you know, whatever, you know, buzzword talking points that just feel stale and eye roll inducing. He's out there just sort of like holding court doing that. And it's, he's ignoring Corbin. He's trying to get himself over with sort of this smirky heel instead of getting over Corbin. And I think he would defend himself and say, no, I'm saying that Corbin would be a star in any era. And, but in the process, he's saying this current era sucks compared to the Attitude Era, which is a really weird thing for Levesque to allow him to say. But then Levesque is a guy, you know, who said, you know, he and Undertaker were the last of the Smash Mouth generation or whatever it was, and just demeaned everybody else in WWE when he's like, yeah, you know, we're the last reason for you to ever buy a ticket to see wrestling. That's essentially the promo he cut. So maybe in a way I shouldn't be surprised. But what's your take on the JBL Corbin stuff, what I said, and also what Jay said?
Let me mull this over for half a second, make sure what I'm about to say is not hyperbolic and actual what I think. I think the handling of what they did with Baron Corbin and JBL probably would be Triple H's worst decision. Worst handled thing, I would say. First off, Baron Corbin does not need a mouthpiece. Baron Corbin could cut his own promos. He's engaging. That's one thing. Number two, JBL is very charismatic. He holds attention, and he is more charismatic than Baron Corbin. So, like you said, he dwarfs Baron Corbin when he's out there, and it does make it seem like it's about JBL, and Corbin's just the one wrestling for him. Corbin does not need that. When I first saw JBL pick him up, I thought that the best way they could have handled it would be JBL is never leaves his limo, because that would be his character. His character is that this is not good enough for – this town is not good enough for me. As a matter of fact, the only time he should have come out of the limo is for Texas. You know, he never gets out of the limo. He doesn't even need to – be at the shows, and then it's just Baron Corbin talking to, you know, somebody in the limo, and then, you know, and then you only hear Baron Corbin's side of the argument, and getting advice from, you know, presumably JBL in the limo. You don't need him, because it's just he overshadows Corbin. Then you have Corbin is still in, even though he's Baron Corbin, he's still doing the, you know, the Happy Corbin, you know, dressed like Happy Corbin. And he should be coming out, if he's going to be teaming up with JBL, he needs to be coming out in a suit. He needs to be looking like JBL. Give him a cowboy hat like JBL. He should, you know, if your goal is to have him, you know, be the next wrestling god, have him emulate JBL. In give it his own twist, you know, or not one-to-one copy, but at least your own version of that. This is just I'm just don't understand what they're really going for, unless Triple H owed JBL money, and this is you know letting him get on camera to do stuff. So it boggles my mind that the way that turn the TV off heat for me, to be honest. So,
and it comes across also like JBL and Corbin don't talk. Like JBL shows up, he's like, I'll go do my thing. You just follow along, son. And they don't have like an actual chemistry or dynamic that they've worked out at all. It really just does seem like JBL coming out there and just going, I'm a star, and I'm going to spin my magic, and you just stand there and let me elevate you.
You just stand there and let me give you the rub. I'm just standing there and give you the rub. That's what it sounds like.
And I think the audience cares more about, and this is quite a statement, but I think the audience cares more about Baron Corbin right now than JBL. I think they're more interested in his story and what he's doing next after the journey with Happy Corbin and all that stuff, then they are JBL just spewing, you know, these, you know, eye rolling troll, social media troll, conservative platitudes. Do you disagree?
That's pretty much
JBL might be more charismatic, but I think fans care more about Baron Corbin right now.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. There is no purpose for if JBL's not going to get in the ring, there's no purpose.
Yeah.
There's no purpose for him to take that much spotlight away from, you know, because I mentioned that when I talked about how Vince McMahon views things, that it's all about the spotlight that is on the wrestler, and he, you know, which is why he got rid of Lashley's group, because, you know, all the spotlight needs to be on Lashley, not the Hurt Business. And the thing is that in this case, all the spotlight is on JBL. He's on commentary, and I'm sorry, just him saying, oh, this guy's the next wrestling god, this guy's the next wrestling god. Look how great he is. Look how great he is. It's like we need, you know, we need more than that. You know, and you're taking up too much oxygen.
All right.
Not the human being. I don't want him dead, you know. Just
right. Yes. Well, I mean, no, I'm kidding. totally. Yeah. I was making fun of you, not actually a thought in my head. All right. Up next, Zach in Texas says, as I watch Raw, I just sit here and think that there are so many simple things that Triple H could do to make this show so much better. Ultimately, it comes back to the same basic premise and purpose. If Roman Reigns is going to hold both belts, he needs to be regularly present on both shows, or at least alternating which show he appears on and defends the belt each month, not just popping in when he feels like it. Whichever show he's not on in a given month can be building a challenger for him. How much better would it be if Rhea Ripley was focusing on the women's title, Priest was focusing on the U.S. title, Finn was focusing on the heavyweight title, and Dom was a glorified pin taker? Their claim to running Raw would have real teeth. JBL could have formed a new million-dollar corporation with a similar purpose, of which Baron Corbin was a part, instead of basically turning Baron into a Rocka Corbin. What's the end game for Riddle and Elias with no tag titles in play? Facing Alpha Academy 15 times? Nikki Cross is back, but there's no reason to believe she'll do more than take the pin at Blood Money 9. Non-title women's stories are non-existent, which is a shame. Miz can be a small part of Johnny Gargano's story, but he also needs a purpose like the U.S. title. They have these titles to focus a story on and give purpose, so use them. So another email, Javier, wanting the titles to be more of a driving force in the stories that WWE tells. And I would like that. I would prefer it. But the absence of it, given WWE structure, what Paul Levesque inherited, the cadence of events now, which is different than it used to be. Now, you know, the Saudi shows count as a pay-per-view. Before, they were extra. There's just a different cadence to things and different demands. And I just don't know if that's going to be part of WWE booking. You know, I almost think it's, you have to resign yourself to it not being. So I think AEW should do that. I think they're promoting a different style and to the audience that Zach, you know, he's Tony Khan is booking in a way where if you're a fan of what Zach just wrote, you want AEW to do an even better job in that front. But I think it's wrong to think WWE has to do that or they're bungling things. Like, I just think having the Judgment Day each have a belt that they're going after, if they're not going to get a title shot on the horizon, or if they do, it's going to be some TV match that Reigns just wins and defines Finn down because he loses. I just don't know if I think there's some peril that comes with that sort of dream that Zach has of a WWE more built around challengers and titles. Javier.
It's interesting because ultimately the important thing is what gets you tuned in to watch. So if you have a storyline involving a blood feud where the title's not on the line, that might be your hottest storyline. The mega powers explode was carried more by its storyline. If you remove any titles, were there titles at that point? Remind me.
When
the mega powers exploded?
No. Oh, good question. I don't think so.
Yeah, so that was the hottest storyline. I mean, even whether they were involved
even
or
if
not.
They were, it was overshadowed by the mega powers. Yeah. I mean, it just wasn't about them. Yeah.
Exactly, and there have been moments where, you know, the storyline that's going on is more important than whatever's going on with the title. Ideally, you want to keep the title strong because that is what's going to keep driving, you know, it is a story that you can tell. It is a version of the story, you know, the title being strong and the fight over that title. But if you have compelling stories like what's going on with the Bloodline, I haven't even thought about who's going to be defending the title because of what's going on with the Bloodline and the involvement of Roman Reigns in that storyline. When it comes to that, they have done a good job with the Intercontinental, right, is the one that Intercontinental with Gunther. They're done a good job because of the matches that he's had with Sheamus. That's drawn attention to that, and hopefully you continue building that. So you could have that be like what carries your week to week programming is having a strong Intercontinental champion, and then like your title is like your super title, your over title, you know, the ones that's going to sell you the pay-per-view, the ones going to get you to the, you know, to the big matches. Because, you know, I'll give you my example with AEW. Great wrestling all the time, you know, but really excited the first couple weeks. But, you know, you could only see these acrobatic stunts so much, and they all start blending together. So just, you know, you need something more, you know. So I'm going to get really nerdy here. I read an article a long time ago about how you know the Magic the Card Magic the Gathering card game?
I'm aware of it, yes.
Yeah, well, in each deck, in each card set, there are cards that are obviously better than others and cards that are obviously worse than others. And the whole idea is because when you that way, the people to get invested into the game, they're looking for those good ones. They know that those bad ones exist, but, you know, but it creates peaks and valleys. And when you're telling a story and like booking a show is telling a story, you also need those peaks and valleys. If everything that you're watching on TV is the most important thing, then nothing's really important. You need to have some stuff. You need to have your mid-card stuff. You have to have your low-card stuff. So, you know, and then where you ideally want your title to be the most important peak, but it's not always going to be that way.
By the way, did this seem – I thought we got an email on it, but maybe it was social media. Did it seem like the Dallas crowd was not – it just was kind of like blah tonight
for
the most
part? Yeah, I saw someone tweeted that the crowd was hot for Bianca when she came out, and I'm like, maybe they didn't come across on my TV, but it felt like everybody was dead. I mean, I was very surprised. I mean, they were blah because, I mean, they were up for Roman. They were up for Roman. I think they were also up for that, for the Theory Rollins match. But yeah, I think the crowd really hit the same dip that I did. Cause I mean, I found it rough getting past that middle section of the show.
Have we covered everything on the show? I feel like a couple emails kind of hit a lot of the points that I was going to bring up. I mean, with Damian Priest losing to Carl Anderson, I guess that is noteworthy because Carl Anderson sort of feels like the Bobby Fish, Buddy Roberts of the trio, and you know he's there to do jobs. But I guess having him beat Damian Priest, even with a distraction, feels like it's defining down Damian Priest more than is worth the gain you get from giving Anderson a win back.
Yeah, I think that's them basically volleyballing 50-50 booking, particularly since, you know, again, they just came back, so you don't want them losing again. Yeah, you had the distraction. I did like the post-match beatdown because Judgment Day is coming across more like Bullet Club than the OC is, which is something I found interesting. Mm-hmm. I got a hand to Dominic his acting chops where like he's all like confident stuff, and the moment he gets slapped in the face, man, that guy folds like a house of cards, you know. And he shows confidence and then it breaks. And I think that's very when it comes to his acting chops. I think he's doing a good job in the role that he's playing.
Yeah, I agree. How do you feel about Mustafa Ali and how he's doing in his role?
Man, I kind of pull for him, but I don't know. It's just like, I don't know if it's the matchups that he's put in. Something just never, it never seems, because you kind of have to be the right guy at the right time, and it seems like it's never really the right time for him, because like they're putting him into you know, I kind of alluded to it earlier, that it looks like they're heading into a program with him and Seth Rollins, you know, where he he's not going to get his another title shot until he proves that he deserves it, because he had already lost once to Rollins. It looks like that's the destination for Ali. But Rollins in this place where he's kind of like a quasi, he's like the heel people like, and I don't think that's, you know, is good, bodes well for Mustafa Ali, because I don't think the people have really, like, you know, he has some like super fans who are like really into him, but you really got to like capture the imagination of more than just a few people. You got to capture the entire audience, and I don't think he's been able to do it there. I put him in the same realm as Ricochet, only slightly higher, you know, in terms, you know, right. I think, you know, Ricochet just can't, I don't think he's going to do it, but he's more personable. I think he has a better shot at like breaking through, but I don't think this program is going to let him break through.
Yeah. I don't have talking points on Mustafa other than I want it to work, but I'm not sure in the way that Paul Levesque is presenting the product that it will work, but I get the sense Levesque wants it to work. And I just can't quite put my finger on what is slowing down or creating sort of this sludge of Ali with all his attributes seeming like this is a more exciting moment for WWE fans to see him, you know, getting TV time. And I can't put my finger on it. I genuinely don't know what my advice would be to fix what just seems like is keeping Ali from breaking through with a push and a crowd reaction that matches his likability and his talent. And I don't know what it is.
I think that his best chance is if he gets like a storyline of the caliber, what they're doing with the Bloodline, something that's dramatic like that. I just want to, beat a bunch of people so I could get a shot at Seth Rollins again. And then the problem solver thing, that's more platitudes, than anything else. And it could just be that, you know, like there's some wrestlers that, I call like the camera. I look at it through like the camera. So for some reason that when they're on in a stage as big as WWE, they kind of like, it seems like they shrink. However, when you see the same character in like, a smaller promotion, for some reason they feel like their charisma comes through better. I don't know exactly what does that. Ethan Page, for example, when he was in Impact, like really filled the camera for me. He was like a character I could really glom onto. But then in AEW, and AEW has a whole host of problems, but the camera also doesn't really, like, he doesn't fill the camera like he does when he's in Impact. I'm not sure what it is about that, but some wrestlers don't fill the camera. And Mustafa Ali was one that filled the camera when he was 205. It was a smaller crowd, and obviously it was shot closer because he didn't want to see the empty arena, you know, as people were leaving the show. And then like he kind of filled the 205 camera. He filled, you know, that you know, during that era. For some reason, when he's in the WWE, it doesn't. And I think, you know, I don't know what causes that.
He's also just been around a long time, spinning his wheels and asking fans to then see him in a higher spot is a challenge. I mean, I don't know. He's had some start and stop pushes and gimmicks, and there just might be enough of a history of him not, or maybe there's just something about him that's missing that you know we're not coming to terms with, because he is really likable and talented and a good worker, a solid promo. I think he's not been great on promos, but he's solid. I don't know. He just might be too nice of an ordinary guy to jump out in how they're pushing him. But anyway, that's an ongoing story, and you know, I hope something clicks. What have you thought of the Omos and Braun Strowman hype with the MVP promo tonight? I mean, there wasn't a lot to it, but did they do enough, and is it making sense for what they have to work with? Because what I've been saying is this isn't a match that like super intrigued me, but the 11-year-old would have been really into this. The 11-year-old me, it would have been like, oh, this is going to be great. And I think they know it's kind of this niche audience that's going to be into seeing two giants. It's going to be scoffed at by the grown-ups who see this as nonsense and extraneous and not necessary for WWE and more of a turnoff. And they might be right that it might be more of a turnoff than it's worth in 2022. But the fact is that they're doing the match. And there's going to be some people who like it. I don't know if it's a net positive or a net negative overall for the product, but some people are going to be into it. They may or may not exist in the Saudi Arabia crowd in a noticeable way. But if you're going to do it, show Braun tipping things over and have Braun go, you might be taller, but I'm stronger. And you have MVP come back and say, you know, Omos is going to prove to be the dominant giant and undercutting what Braun says. I mean, it feels sort of like just solid 101 promos and video packages back and forth to build this up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not unintrigued. I mean, it's not like Southern's going to make me rush out and buy tickets to a show that these two are headlining. I'm not, you know, it's a spectacle of, you know, the, was Giant Gonzalez versus The Undertaker, only hopefully both these two wrestle better.
Yeah, I'm not sure. What do you think?
He almost improved a little bit. I don't think it can be worse. Let's put it that way. I'm like not like I said, I'm not unintrigued, and it's basically the storyline. And this is going to be a spoiler for the primer. What was it that came up with? It's the giant monster versus the monstrous giant. That's, you know, the story of the match. And like I said, it's an intriguing, you know, it's an intriguing matchup. I handed it to them. They did better than what AEW did when they were doing Brian Cage versus Wardlow, which is the same kind of thing, except those two can actually go at it. You know what I mean? And they've done more build for this. So.
And
by the way, did you notice how clean those ceilings were?
No.
Yeah, because, you know, I was paying attention to the ceiling since they're going to give us those shots whenever Almas is out there.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Nicely done. There's one other small thing on the show I wanted to throw to you on. Oh, yeah. Nikki Cross. What do you think of the follow-up to last week's reintroduction of her?
I mentioned earlier, it's just I would not have beat her. Because, I mean, you just basically, you've given a chance to... She comes back and you're given a chance to reframe her. And even though it was, again, because of the distraction, you know, why pin her? I would have actually preferred if it ended up with Damage Control just hitting the ring and it being a no contest. I think that would have been much better than, you know, having her take a pin despite, you know, even with the distraction.
All right, my final topic for you, Javier, is not from Raw. It was touched on. Bray Wyatt, he's going to be on SmackDown again on Friday. We talked about, you know, we got to move forward. Even if it's not, you know, it's not big touchdown passes, it's got to move forward. What did you think of Bray Wyatt's promo last Friday? And where's your head at in terms of where you think they're going with him?
Pretty much the same where someone that he's hurt in the past is going to play mental games. Either it's going to be like his splinter personality, so he's basically feuding with himself, which I doubt. I think it's more likely it's going to be an outside agent that's going to make him think that. Some of the reference I'm assuming that we're going to call him Uncle Howdy. He said that you threw him away, which I think is a reference that when he left, he threw the Fiend away, and now the Fiend's taken on a life of its own, is kind of what he's implying. Or it might actually mention that he threw, like, someone away, like maybe a Rowan or, you know, somebody who he's going to end up feuding with. That's kind of my thing. I have heard that it's likely, you know, that Bray Wyatt's going to be the baby. It's going to be a baby face, which I think it's, you know, a smart thing to do. And we're going to be seeing him wrestle, you know, the demons of his past. So I think before was when it was the Fiend, he was wrestling with the wrongs that were done to him. Now the wrongs that he did are going to come back to haunt him, which is a nice, you know, coda to the story.
Yeah. Yep. Are you are you enjoying his performances, how he's pulling off what you're describing?
Yeah, I really like what he's doing. The Howdy thing was a little bit weird. The pacing of it I had issues with, because what he essentially just ended up doing was kind of the same promo. I mean, really, the one from Friday felt almost identical to the one from the Friday before, only had the one Friday before gone 5 more minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because all it had was the exact same thing. It was he basically said the exact same stuff that he said. Then the camera came out, and then like last time it cut, and then this time it like we got a little bit more, and you know, oh, you're a liar, and Uncle Howdy. There was also a QR code during that, which is a picture of Bray Wyatt with liar written all over his face. Which is, you know, I mean, that basically solidified the fact, I think, that it's an outside entity that is messing with him, you know, so we'll see where that goes. I mean, and most likely it's Bo Dallas, would be my guess.
That's what I'm going to say. Yeah. Is there a list, or is it just Bo Dallas or someone we're not thinking of?
Yeah. I mean, Bo Dallas, I still think that he doesn't do stuff like, you know, cause it was the Wyndham Six, I think is the handle. You know, and now they're calling it the Wyatt Six. I don't think that's a mistake. That's going to be played in some way, shape, or form. What I'm thinking is that it's going to be six people that he's wronged, who are going to come after him, and they're each probably likely going to take an aspect of one of the Firefly Funhouse characters in order to screw with him. Because, you know, that was also one of the big things that they showed was, like, the destroyed Firefly Funhouse. And, you know, so one character representing Husky Harris and, each of the characters, which is why one of the characters is likely going to be Sister Abigail. So he's going to need a female character to, you know, wrestle on that character on his behalf, which is I'm leaning towards Alexa Bliss and Liv Morgan. But, you know, we'll see, because, you know, again, other women are coming, you know, they're looking into signing other women. So maybe they have somebody else in mind.
Yeah, they're very good. Anything else from Raw you want to bring up?
I mentioned that I'm really liking the fact that they're weaving the story, because it engages you more with what you're watching, weaving the stories throughout. I think it was Tom who was on last week. He touched on that, and I think that was very that's been, I think, of all the stuff that Triple H has done, I think that's been one of my favorite things, because it doesn't make the show feel as much as a chore usually. And just your opinion on the trick or treat street fight, because we've seen a lot of these, you know, like the holiday ones. Did this one feel a little bit more serious with what they were doing in the ring, even though they were like, you know, messing around with, you know, you had all the stuff on the outside? It didn't feel like it was as ridiculous. I mean, there's some level of ridiculousness in it, but it didn't feel like other ones that we've seen before that was like, whatever.
Well, it was 8 minutes with a commercial break in the middle, and there had to be time for, you know, the pumpkin spot. I don't know. I mean, I guess I'd have to review. Because Otis and Riddle are just, you know, they're good workers. So there was some good stuff there, but it did feel like they just went right into shtick at the beginning, and coming out of the break, they went right into shtick. I mean, someone got their, you know, Riddle threw Otis headfirst into a chair wedge in the corner. So it was a little violent. There were some kendo sticks. So, I mean, it wasn't like the weapons were that they were selling, brutality that wasn't brutal, but it was hard. It was hard for me to look past the pumpkins in the foreground, in the background. And, you know, even going into the break when Graves said, you know, I assure you it's going to get weirder as they cut to a break. You know, that's a feature, not a flaw. Stay tuned, folks, you know. But, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I know why you asked that. I'm just not sure I'm ready to say.
It might be that I think the New Day has been involved in all of these previous ones.
Oh, God.
And why those feel more goofy than usual. You know, those feel more goofy than this one did. That might be it, because, you know, like, you know, there were a couple spots I'm like, wow, this felt a lot more harder than what these things usually are. That's probably why I was just, you know, just speculating, because it felt a little bit different. Not much. I mean, I'm not saying that's like, you know, 6-star match, but
yeah, no, fair enough. Fair enough. Cool. Javier, thank you. Tell people what you do for the Torch and why they should read and listen.
I write the primers for the pay-per-views for AEW and WWE. I occasionally tweet out with a tweet. It's late. I have a New Japan Pride podcast, which is I usually do the tournaments and stuff and jump in when there's a big show. I have fallen behind, and I got Eric on Twitter talking about like all this great stuff that's going on in New Japan. I'm like, you know, this is a great match. Oh, this is an awesome match. I'm like, yeah, I got to get around to catching up on a lot of stuff I've missed. Apparently, this tournament for the I almost want to call it 24/7 title. It is late, Wade. TV title. That's what it is. TV, right? That's what. Yeah. Apparently, that's, you know, I've heard a lot of good things. The matches they've had there, so I got to go back and tune into that.
All right, Javier, because it's late and you know you're just sort of losing your ability to string sentences together, we will end here. Thank you so much. Always great having you for the full show. So thanks. We'll talk to you soon. We appreciate our callers and emailers, of course, our listeners, and especially our VIP members. Go VIP, and you can hear these shows with the ads and plugs removed and get 35 years of archives and a lot of bonus content. More than bonus content, really our core content is on the VIP side of things. So go check it out, pwtorch.com/govip. Thanks, Javier. Thanks, everybody. Until next time, Wade Keller signing off.